Welcome to the Coaching and Therapy channel. So this channel is quite close to my heart because I train coaches in embodiment. I mean, why? Because if you don't work with the body, you're missing a lot. Whether you're a coach, a therapist, facilitator, whatever, that's how you go deep quickly. That's how you do stuff that's sticky. We have to take the body into account. This channel is sponsored by Dylan Newcombe and Uzazu Embodied Intelligence. Dylan is a genius, quite simply put, and I wouldn't say that about many people in this field. I've been studying with Dylan for, God, the first time was probably 10 years ago in the Netherlands. Speaks fluent Dutch, by the way, as well as Korean and a few other languages. What I love about Dylan is his ability to make models of things, looking at how embodiment works. His system, Uzazu, U-Z-A-Z-U, is really all about state shifting. So I think of him as the sort of master of state changing, how we can shift our state, our client's state, and how we can develop ourselves through those different ways of being. So I think for coaches and therapists, it's like easy to learn, practical toolkit. I've used it myself over the years. So if you want a 3-day online training with Dylan, then look at the link below, or you can go to Uzazu, uzazu.org. And even easier, he's got an embodied assessment there you can do as well. We all love doing these little tests about ourselves, but this is an embodied one. So there you go. Welcome to the Coaching and Therapy channel. I'm going to be on this one a lot just because there's lots of cool people on here. Lots of people, I think, you know, well worth a listen. Embodiment in facilitation is so necessary. So from me to you, welcome.
Fantastic. Kevin Billett is a world leading expert in conscious life transformation, positive living, and authentic leadership. He is joint founder and CEO of the Journey Group of Companies. He is Brandon Bay's husband, Journey Method collaborator, and business partner of 20 years. He has developed and supported many acclaimed live and online seminars. Kevin co-wrote Consciousness, the New Currency with Brandon Bay's. His latest book, Light in the Heart of Darkness, reached Amazon bestseller status and is largely based on his story of healing completely from depression, using the Journey Method and teaching others how to do the same. Born in Wales, if this is our Woodstock, Kevin is our Tom Jones. And today he's going to sing to us. You have a voice that really captures my ear. And in research, it's been quite lovely to hear that kind of Welsh choir role to the way that you bring language into life. So anyway, today you're going to sing to us about ancient wisdom and the modern insights that we can draw on. Kevin, the floor is yours, and thank you.
I'll sing in a speaking voice, if you don't mind, because I'll take the flattery about the voice, but my singing voice is not a traditional Welsh singing voice, Matthew, so thank you very much, and welcome, everyone. I would love to share with you today a model that's been a major influence in my life for just under a quarter of a century. This model is called the Enneagram. It's something that has taught me daily since I first discovered it. It's a model of self-introspection that really uncovers what's going on deep underneath the surface for us, so that we can be aware of how we trip ourselves up in life. You know, I don't know if you're the same as me, but I went through life up until 25 years ago really wondering why the hell I did things the way I did them. You know, I had my goals out there. I was driven in certain ways. I wanted to achieve certain things in life, but I kept tripping myself up. I kept self-sabotaging. I kept finding that certain patterns were coming to the surface, and I had no clue what was driving them. Patterns where I would need to be obsequious and peacekeeping and nice to people rather than really going and telling them what I thought. And I recognized as well that I was a person who couldn't be told what to do. I needed to dig my feet in. I needed to be kind of dragged to the next discussion and to the next decision in life. That I was quite resistant to anyone, I mean, not just telling me what to do, but actually asking me what to do. And then way back in 1996, Brandon, my wife, gave me a book and she said, please take a look at this and see if there's a chapter that really kind of appeals to you, if there's something that describes what's going on for you. And of course, it was an Enneagram book. And it was a complete switch on of like the deep lights inside. And here's what it is, okay? This is a model that was developed originally by ancient Sufis, mystic Sufis. And they had a belief that we come into life facing in one of nine directions, and that the direction in which we're facing is the next spiritual lesson for us. It's the next ego unlocking that we need to face. And so they would be passed from teacher to teacher. This was an oral tradition, but they recognized that there are nine ways in which our ego essentially can express. So nine ways we can buy into the lie of limited self, nine ways in which we can identify as something other than the spacious awareness, the pure consciousness that we are. And from that, that teaching, they passed it on. They passed student on to master and to master. And this was an oral tradition passed on apparently for centuries until it was picked up on in the mid-20th century, modernized and codified and put built into a graphic model. And it's that model that I want to share with you today. As I'm going through this, I want to invite you just to, rather than listen just with your ears and with your brain, listen with your body. Listen, this is the embodiment conference after all. I want you to listen, if you would, deeply inside to kind of process the information at a gut level, at a deeper intuitive level, and to recognize what of this may be true about you, and subsequently what may be true about some people who are pretty close to you. So let's have a look here. Here's the, I'm going to share some graphics with you, and we'll see if we can build this model in simple terms here. So let's have a look. Let's start with this one. Okay, great. So here's the basic premise of the Enneagram. The premise is that when we're born initially, maybe in the womb, it's not really clear, but definitely shortly after birth, spacious awareness, so the consciousness that we are, the essence of us, is incarnated and makes a fundamental mistake. It's often referred to as the initial mistake. So the self, the intelligent emptiness of being, identifies in one of three ways, and you can see them inside the triangle here. We identify as a body, as emotion or emotions, or as mind. So if we start at the top here, we go, okay, incarnation, baby is born, wind the cameras back, if you will, and then baby feels its own body. The earliest cell memories that I've uncovered with this were of being born and being swaddled as a baby. So being tied up in the sheets that they would wrap a baby in with your arms kind of stuck to your side there. And all of a sudden, what was pure presence, what was pure beingness feels like it's been contained in this body. Feels like it's been imprisoned, straitjacketed. And out of that, the rage of having all control taken away from you, the rage of being controlled, and then the need subsequently to get back control, to avoid being controlled and to be in control. So we identify as body. The result is anger and rage. And if we identify as a body, this undercurrent, this emotional undercurrent of anger and rage is there all the time. And it exists right through our life from the time we're born or shortly afterwards until the time we leave this life. It doesn't go anywhere. Now, we can be healthy with that, relatively healthy. We can be unhealthy with it. And it's a theme. It's a life or death theme that we need control. And the mechanism of gaining control is through this anger and rage. So it doesn't go anywhere until we wake up to the pattern, we recognize what's there, and then we can do something about it. While we're asleep to it, it's controlling us. The game is controlling us. The emotions are appearing to own us all the time. So our default reaction here, if someone tweaks us, if our emotions are jolted by something unexpected in life, if someone hurts us in some way, initial response, anger and rage here. Because we feel out of control, we've got to get back into control. Contrast that with those who've identified down on the right-hand side here with emotion. With emotion, it's said that the ananda, the love bliss of consciousness, incarnates and feels separated from the love, separated from the beauty, separated from the goodness, from the joy, from the bliss. and is desperate to get back to it. Instead of the bliss, then there are these tumultuous emotions. And some of them feel scary, some of them feel threatened, some of them feel painful. And so there's a sense of being booted out of the nest. There's a sense of being unfairly punished. And there's a sense out of this emotionally, you'll see it written down here, of underlying unworthiness and worthlessness that is terrifying to us. It feels like we're stripped of all worth. We're completely unlovable as people. And we are desperate to reconnect with the love, to reconnect with the bliss. And a whole series of life games become compensatory of this perceived unworthiness and worthlessness. And we must create an image of worth, an image of lovability, an image of worthiness, if you like, in life. And so again, these are life and death issues that stay with us from very early in life when we make the initial mistake, right through until we pass away if we don't wake up to them. They're there all the time. If we're tweaked here underneath unworthiness, unlovability, worthlessness itself, also here a sense of shame that this would be true about us. So I'm asking you again, listen with your body here. Do you recognize this? You know, your default reaction in life, what is that? If someone tweaks you, even if it's just for a fleeting moment, what is it you feel? This is very different if I identify as mind over here. So in this case, we've identified as thinking, as intellect, as the words, the pictures, the sounds that float through consciousness. We become mind-based. Our focus is here. Our sense of self is conceptual here. This is very destabilizing. This is very different from the other two. If you identify with mind, mind can shift on a dime. It can make its mind up one moment, it can be dead sure, and then the next minute it's doubting itself. And so it's a destabilizing way of identifying. And that instability produces an undercurrent of fear and terror. It's there all the time. It's there in the background, whether we acknowledge it or not. And from this, of course, we're mind-based. How do we compensate for fear and terror? And this is life or death, fear and terror. We fear that if we go there, that it'll be the undoing of us, it'll be the end of us, that it's not an option to dive into the fear, to feel it fully. It's just we've got to manage it some way. And the way we manage it here, obviously, is mind-referenced. It's learning, understanding, and this desperate need for the knowledge that will keep fear and terror at bay, the knowledge that will combat the fear and the terror. Again, life issue from shortly after birth until the day we die, unless we wake up to this stuff. So just check yourself quickly at the moment and go, okay, what do I recognize here? If someone tweaks me, if something unexpected jolts me, what's my default reaction here? Because this is telling, and this is a life issue. If you can recognize it, and not all of us can straight away, it can take a little bit of exploration. This will give you some real indicators of what life is inviting you to explore and to free yourself from. So out of this, we've made a mistake here, initial mistake. Instead of I am freedom, instead of I am pure consciousness, empty intelligence, infinite, I am a body, I am emotion or emotions, or I am mind. And then the consequences of that, lifetime's worth of consequences. So let's take another step forward and have a look at this one. And we go, okay, if we've identified, similar thing here, I am body, I am image or emotions, I am mind. And the Sufis believed that the flavor of consciousness that existed before incarnation dictates where we land here. So you'll see at the top with I am the body. These are the mistakes of identification. So the Enneagram is pointing to who you are not. The Enneagram is describing the trap of ego, the trap of fixation. A lot of people use it to describe personality. Personality is not who you are. Personality is a result of these mistakes that we've made. So we're saying here, if the flavor of consciousness prior to incarnation was pure being, then I am body. Out of this, if I'm the body, if I'm driven by anger, if I'm driven by rage, if I need to take control, if I need to avoid being controlled, then energetically, the way I move through life is by moving against energetically. I use a force of will habitually, and I'm talking pretty much all the time here. Again, this is a factor of life that doesn't come and doesn't go. This is just a feature of the fixation of the ego style that's here. So moving against means we're embattled in life. It's like we see life as a battlefield or as a kind of like a game of wills, and we must prevail in order to survive. Life or death issues here. And so we're pushy in life, or we're resistant in life and need to be dragged along, kind of the way I described to you earlier on. So definitely this moving against others, we feel like we're challenging life and needing to prevail here in order to survive. Very different if we come down to the right-hand side of the triangle here. Again, the Sufis would say here, this was hanging out as love, bliss, ananda would be the Sanskrit word for it, prior to incarnation. Then this identification with emotions and the need to create an image of lovability. So separation from the love itself, separation from bliss into the tumult of emotion, identifying as that tumult, and then needing to wear a mask of lovability, of approvability, of adorability, of uniqueness, these types of things. And then, of course, if we need to prove that we're lovable, where can we prove that? We can only prove that in reference to other people. We see it in their faces, we hear it in their words and their tonality, we see it reflected back to us. So if we're looking for a sense of self by wearing a mask, needing to connect with other people to get that feedback, the feedback that we need to survive here, then of course we need to move towards energetically. We need to reach out to others. We need to connect with others. We need to be either empathetic or impressive to others so they'll see us and affirm, oh yes, not really unworthiness here. Of course you're worthy. Of course you're approvable. Absolutely you're lovable, like this. So in this case, energetically, we're reaching out in life either to impress others or to connect with them and get the verbal and non-verbal feedback that we need to survive here. Again, coming back to this, these are life or death issues. Contrast that. The Sufis would say omniscience, so universal knowing, mindless, infinite knowing, would incarnate, separate from the universal omniscience, and settle as intellectual knowing, so human mind-driven understanding. And this mistake, I am the mind. And then if we're going through life consulting the mind, trying to figure out all the time, trying to understand whatever it is we think we need to understand to avoid, if you remember, the fear and the terror, then guess what? We need to move away energetically. Now, this may be subtle or it may be quite blatant, and some of us literally move away and kind of barricade ourselves off in life. For others of us, it's much more subtle than that, in that we can be connected socially, but still, you know, we're kind of back here a little bit consulting our thoughts, even as well, you know, at the same time as we're smiling and engaged and nodding and going, yes, I'm engaged with you, being social. There's a little bit of pulling back, this subtle moving away to consult with our thoughts internally. So what do you recognize here? What's your theme in life? Do you move against with a force of will to stop being controlled? Even though you may play nice games around this, do you recognize that? Do you recognize life as a bit of a battle, life as a game of wills? Or do you recognize needing to reach out and connect with others in order to prove who you are, to prove your worth? Or is this subtly, at least subtly, moving away to mind? Withdrawing to consult, is this right, is this wrong? Is this safe, is this not safe? Is this coming from something I want to believe or something I'm resisting, like this? Okay, cool. If you got that, we'll move on to the next one. Now, this is expanding it a little bit. We're not still at the Enneagram here. We're going to come to that in the next diagram. But let's just expand on some of the qualities here. So being incarnates at the top of the triangle here in red, identifies as body. So the sense here is I am a thing, I am a physical form. this kind of flesh and blood and bone in time and space. There's a definite physicality to it. And we've said out of that, underlying emotions of anger and rage all the time. I mean, anger and rage, if you're tweaked, I mean, we're all tweaked, I mean, normally several times in a day. Here's the default reaction with body point ego, body point fixation. Because we've identified as a body, the undercurrent here is fear of physical attack all the time. It's like, you know, there are bigger, tougher, wilder, more feral animals out there who are a risk, who could attack me, who could take me down physically at any time. So that fear is in the background of our minds all the time. And we've said, because we feel ultimately the control has been taken away from us, that we've been controlled to the maximum extent in life, there's this desperate need for control of self, in other words, body, because there's the mistake, of others, and of life itself. So our games are games of control to compensate for the fears, to compensate for the fact that we feel out of control and weak. In many, many cases, we'll feel either inadequate or weak, or that there's something really kind of vulnerable about us, and we need to protect it. We protect it through control. And we've said we move against life. We're moving against life with a force of will. It's a very different experience here with the experience of emotional fixation. So I am my emotions. I am my image. So I wear a mask and I pretend that I'm the mask. I'm separated from the love. What I'm feeling, what I'm tweaked, the undercurrent here, unworthiness, worthlessness, unlovability should be in there as well, and shame. So if throughout the day, if someone challenges me, if something doesn't go my way, if someone criticizes me, these are the types of undercurrent emotions that come to the surface. Then what? Fear of abandonment here. Fear that I'm going to be rejected. Fear that my mask will be seen through and people will see the worthlessness that's underneath the mask, the ugliness that's underneath the mask. And then that they'll ignore me. They'll separate, they'll move away, they'll abandon me. This is terrifying for people fixated in this place. And then out of that, these games, desperate, desperate need for love, approval, and admiration. So they need to believe in the mask themselves. They need you to see the mask and to affirm, yes, this is who you are. You're beautiful, you're unique, you're successful, worthy, great, these types of adjectives. Knowing all along, you know, we know underneath at the deepest level, we know this is not the truth about us. We know we're faking it to some extent, but we don't go there. It's too scary to go there. And so these issues keep getting buried and buried in life. We can do all sorts of personal growth work, but it's not getting to the real issue. It's the window dressing. It's papering over the cracks. It's just addressing the superficial while all this stuff is sabotaging us at the deepest level. And we know here, last point with the emotional part of the triangle here, we must move towards in some way. We must connect. We must prove ourselves. We must affirm that the mask I'm wearing is the real me, even though we know that's not true. Or we must impress someone with our uniqueness, with our difference, with our specialness in life. So different forms of expression of the mask here, different ways of moving towards, but definitely needing to connect, needing to impress, needing someone else's affirmation that I'm good, I'm worthy, I'm a valuable person. Very different life issues here. If we come over to the blue left-hand side here, and we've said, okay, omniscience incarnates as mind, as thoughts, as concepts, and then what? Destabilizing. So there's fear of fear here. Fear is an undercurrent, but we learn very quickly to be afraid of the fear itself. Terror is here as a backwash pretty much all the time, but we're terrified of being terrified, and we've got to find some way to jump out of it. Here we have also, so if we expand a little bit, fear of insanity. What caused a bit of a fear of insanity? If I am the mind, insanity means, you know, the mind heading towards chaos or breakdown. We're terrified of it, cannot allow it to happen. And so we hold on. Terrified of chaos, terrified of the unknown. We need to know whatever it is we need to know in order to stay safe. So the unknown itself becomes terrifying. If we can't predict, we're in terror. And terror here equals death. So we'll do anything to get out of it. We have this driven need for safety and security. Must find safety that will take us out of this condition of fear. That's a backwash throughout our life. And then we develop avarice for knowledge. So academic knowledge, research knowledge, trying to understand the meaning of life, if you like, the mind of God, this type of knowledge seeking. Or seeking competence, so the rules, the formulas, knowing what to do in order to prevent dangerous situations occurring in life, how to thwart danger before it even arrives. And experience, so average for experience, knowing what to do to jump out of fear, knowing what to do to distract ourselves from the fear that is right at the core of our life experience here. And then we know moving away here, we move away energetically to consult the mind. Now that can really be by anything from kind of almost like withdrawing into a room and closing the door. So we need physical as well as mental space. You know, when we lose ourselves in research online, we spend hours in isolation, this type of thing. Or it can be, as I was describing earlier, very subtle in that we're social, we're engaged, but we're also pulling away and we're consulting the mind internally. So these are the three basic mistakes that form the Enneagram. Now, Enneagram simply means nine-sided model. It's a construct with nine elements to it. And so if we expand on this and take it to a form of the Enneagram here, we'll see something a little bit more animated and a little bit more, I don't know what, entertaining graphic-wise. Come up with me here to the top part here with the body. And we know with the body, rage and anger and need for control, okay? So need to avoid being controlled, need to gain control, to be in control. And that expresses in one of three ways. Our egos express through three different channels. Our egos either lead us to inflation, so bigging ourselves up, if you like, pretending to be bigger than the problem and untouched by life circumstances. So inflation, if you imagine a balloon pumped up and overpumped, it's kind of like that, big, important or enhanced sense of self. So inflation, the first way ego expresses. Deflation is the opposite of that. So to emotionally manage and to express egoically, we will deflate, we'll hide, we'll keep our heads down, we'll play small, we'll pull back, we'll disengage, we'll kind of let the air leak out of our metaphorical balloon until it's shriveled, hoping that no one will notice us, or playing a victim here, okay? It's life's fault. There's nothing that I can do about it. The third way is with rigidity. Rigidity is like toe-to-toeing it with life. It's the form of going, okay, you know, if I follow the rules, if I'm a good boy, a good girl, if I do the right thing, if I know the formulae and I can apply them, if I work hard, then I'm going to be safe. So I'm equal to the challenge here, but I get tense and very structured, often anxious in the way that I express my ego. So we've got inflation, deflation, and rigidity. And we know that we've got the mistake of I am the body, I am emotion, I am mind. And then start with me at point eight here and go, okay, we all know people like this, and maybe you know it intimately, maybe it's your inside world as well as your observed world. The point eight is the inflated version of the body point game. So the challenger, they've got loads of different names here, the warrior, the boss, the bully, many different names for point eight. Inflated body point expression. So to take control, to take charge, I dominate, I blame others, I big myself up, I kind of bulldoze my way through life and become insensitive. Now, why do I do that? And this is the key with the Enneagram. The why I do that is, as well as the fears that all body points have of being out of control and needing control, At point eight, I'm terrified of my own vulnerability. I'm terrified of weakness. I'm terrified of being like a little skinless baby inside. And this is a key to conscious use of the Enneagram. It's the issues that drive these behaviors to the surface that are most important. We can look at the behavior and go, okay, either I do that or I know people who do this. The key to freedom is recognizing, in this case, as well as needing control, I need to avoid at all costs my own weakness, my own vulnerability, my own sense of this baby-like impotence inside. So you'll see the behavior is the opposite of the deep truth of our existence. If we move on to point nine here, same body point, same need for control, same anger and rage underneath, but you wouldn't recognize it. Because this is the deflated version of body point fixation. Deflated, remember, air let out of the balloon. So deflated, because at this point, as well as needing control, I've become terrified of anger and rage. So I'm driven by anger and rage, and I've become, through life conditioning, terrified of it. And if I'm terrified of it and driven by it, I have to control it at all costs. And so I suppress it. I push it down inside the body. And it takes huge energy. And so I get very tired doing that. I pretend to be nice, reasonable, rational. You can see the name here, self-narcotizer. They're also called the peacemaker. They're called the chameleon because they'll sell out all opinions just to keep the peace, to stop from rocking the boat. And it is exhausting. So this looks very unlike the other two in that it's not an active form of control. It's mostly passive-aggressive, passive-resistant control here. It's a very different expression. Last expression of the body points here, the perfectionist, the reformer, the judge, the preacher. This is rigid body point expression. And with rigidity, if we go back to the balloon metaphor, I'd say this is kind of, you know, you pump your balloon up, but it's blocked inside a box. So you're pumping hard from the inside. The box is containing from the outside. It gets uptight, rigid. So with this type, what are we getting here? Well, different fears under the surface causing this to express. Yes, we still need control here. Yes, we're still driven by anger and rage. It's outrage in this case. And with this fixation point, I feel like I've been punished by life, by being put into this human existence. And I seek perfection because I'm terrified that who I am, what I am, is essentially damnable, condemnable. So I fear damnation. Often at point one here, we have a fear of almost like Dantean hell realms, that we're going to be physically tortured in some living or imagined hell. And we will do anything to correct that. And we're seeking perfection at all times. This is like a finger pointing type of control here. Really rigid, moral, ethical, upright, and uptight, often shrill form of control. So you see three very different types of expression here. The thing to focus on is what is driving that behavior and personality expression to the surface. It's the deepest fears. Those fears are gateway to freedom if we turn towards them rather than continue to avoid them. Move down with me to the emotional triad here, the emotional point of the triangle, and you'll see three different expressions here. So with point two, this is inflation, very different form of inflation here because this is an emotional point. So the loving helper, the caregiver, the self-sacrificer. The form of inflation here is quite unusual because it's the inflation of selflessness. I imagine myself to have no needs, to be completely selfless and in service to other people. So I'm loving, I'm reaching out, I'm catering for others, flattering them, uplifting them. I'm doing all sorts of moving towards jobs to smother people in love. Why is this? Because I'm terrified internally that who I am, what I am, is completely worthless and unlovable, that I have this wretched, essential unlovability about me. And so my mask is of being cheerful, loving, helping, no needs for me. Let me figure out what you need, what your issues are, and let me solve them for you. So there's pride here as well, pride in being your best caregiver. It's like I anticipate your needs even before you know you need this stuff. So there's definitely inflation here. Point three, very different. This is the rigid point. These often are the workaholics in life. I mean, a few of us different points can go to workaholism, but with the achiever, this is the status seeker, this is the winner. This is often known as the magician as well. They absolutely need to be approved of. They need to be recognized as being successful. So they need to be number one. Number two means you've lost. And so they get driven to succeed, driven to produce the goods that they can identify with. So, you know, to produce the money, to buy the house, to buy the lifestyle, to buy the car, to buy the holidays, to acquire through status the trophy partner, and then to point at all these accruals and go, oh, there's me. That's me. You know, who am I? Well, just look around. Look at what I've achieved. Look at what I've earned. Look at what I've produced in life. Why do they need to do that as if it's life or death? Because there's complete emptiness, worthlessness, and a sense even of negative self-worth inside, that who they are has a negative value to it, not even neutral, definitely not positive. And so to cover that, to compensate for that, all these drives that ultimately drive them, I mean, nuts with exhaustion, because they can never do enough. It's like a drug of needing more and more and more success. At point four at the bottom here, very different expression again, the tragic romantic. So this case, deflation, I become one of life's victims here. And I need to prove how special I am. I need to prove how unique I am in order to draw the love and the adoration that I need. And in this, I mean, I'm beating myself up emotionally, like I'm a wretched changeling, or I'm misplaced. I was born into the wrong family. So I'm tragically flawed here, and I am seducing by my uniqueness that is proved by my flaw. Very, very different expression. So deflated, I'm a victim of life here. And these are the tragic romantics, the drama queens, the poets, the individualists. So like this. And lastly, if we come around into the mind section here, you'll see three different expressions in this case. The deflated version of mind. So this is the nerd, the geek, the professor, the cave yogi. I really withdraw at this point. I became isolationist. And this is the point that must have the facts, the details, the understanding that's necessary to be safe. Often they ignore their physical needs and they live a very, very cerebral life. We all know people like this. I mean, if you know it from the inside out, you'll recognize huge sensitivity here, huge tenderness here, huge fear of exposure underneath the surface. So underneath, as well as this fear of fear, we have fear of meaninglessness, fear of the unknown, fear of exposure, driving this need to separate from life, to disassociate from life, and living often a very bleak and isolated, self-isolated life. Very different from the doubter. The doubter, also known as the watchdog, the loyalist, the belonger. These are more social people. They have to figure out, what action do I need to take? What strategy do I need in order to avoid the catastrophe that must be coming up? They're terrified internally of being incompetent and of losing it mentally. These are very put together people, because their insecurities here are around, they must be competent, their fear of incompetence, their fear of chaos, their fear of insanity, of losing it mentally. And so they manage to turn the fear into doubt and anxiety, because inside they're always questioning, should I not? Maybe yes, maybe no, like this, constantly on a treadmill of the mind internally, and figuring out what formula do I need, what practical or pragmatic action do I need to take to get out of fear. Last one here, the generalist. You see, we've got the one-man band there. The generalist, sometimes known as the eternal teenager, the Renaissance man or woman. I often call them the escape artists, because they kind of jump out of the fear here. So with the generalist, heightened fear of fear underneath the surface, heightened fear of having options removed, of being grounded, because if I'm grounded, if I'm stopped in life, or if I have to pay attention to the present moment, well, okay, and the fear can come up, and it's a life or death issue here. And so the expression here, I'm happy going, I'm joke telling, I'm on the run all the time, I'm an adventurer, I'm escaping from the reality of day-to-day living with activity, with stories, with up energy. And again, the reason, I'm terrified underneath the surface. So you'll see here different expressions. The last two there, I didn't say this, but the point six would be rigid, obviously very formulaic, and point seven, inflated, in that, you know, I don't have any issues, I'm happy-go-lucky, and this is the way I am in life. The further very interesting thing with the Enneagram here is you'll see the lines connecting up inside the model here. This is a dynamic model. We all experience more than one version of these games, and we're all coldly fixated at one point. In 24 years of studying this, I've yet to come across someone, and I've worked with thousands of people, whose behaviors and whose core fixation is not described by this model. It is dynamic. It teaches on a daily basis. It points back to where we really need to look in order to free ourselves in life, not to paper over the cracks, but to get to the fundamentals. And so I'm going to come back to Matthew and the team here and ask if there are any questions here that you'd like to ask, you'd like me to answer. I'm going to take that down because that's a little bit distracting. Now let's come back to this. Yeah, there you go. So what have we got there, Matthew? Did that make any sense to you? And are there any questions coming up?
There, yes, and yes. So earlier on in the talk, Suzanne asks two questions. Well, reflects, I think, more than that. Oh dear, it's mind I recognize. Is there any hope?
There's okay, I want to say two things here. Hope can be a bit of a distraction. So if you hope, you're not taking action. I'd say stop with the hope and get real. And then there's much more than hope. There's the reality that you can see through the lie of this and take a shortcut to some really deep personal growth. So you know what I'm saying here. Hope kind of postpones. Hope puts some wish out to the future, but you're not really committed to taking the action. And I know that question was probably tongue-in-cheek, and I'd say absolutely there is something you can do about it, about this.
Okay, that's reassuring for me as well. And then 12 minutes later, she reflects, basic mistakes, how can they be transformed into resources?
Well, look, there are two ways we can use the Enneagram. One, and this is at the deepest level, is to see through the lie of identification. And that's an emotional process as well as a spiritual inquiry. It requires self-inquiry into the truth of who and what we are. That often pushes our buttons and produces some strong emotional responses that we've been invited to face, we've been invited to surrender to in life. So at the deepest level, the Enneagram points to the lie of identification and ultimately to the truth of the being, of the presence, the consciousness that's here. Then, and this is more in line with answering the question, of course, from these mistakes, from the machinations of ego fixation, we've learned a lot of skills in life. Now, it's troublesome. It can cause us all sorts of pain and trip-ups if we're compelled to behave in certain ways. And this is what the model points at here. We're compelled to avoid certain emotions. We are driven and utterly compelled to behave in certain ways. So if we can expand the envelope here, and we can, if we can learn to be healthy, learn to see through the lie of the needs and drives that we have, then we can use the skills that we've developed over a lifetime much more effectively. We can be a conscious choice in the way in which we use our strengths in life. So it can teach us at both levels.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I think that in your biography and a lot of your work, that you're a world-leading expert in conscious life transformation and authentic leadership. And I guess this is a useful model for generating that capacity.
Fantastic model, Matthew, because it's a dynamic living model with Brandon and me, this model is teaching us. We're actively exploring it and obviously using it as a teaching tool, but we're diving into it on a daily basis. And I would say it's rarely a day goes by where it doesn't teach us anything. But I mean, to come back to the conscious part here, yes, absolutely. With all the the personal growth and transformation work that I'm involved in, for me, if it's not conscious, it is zero value. You're just kind of window dressing. You're just trying to prettify what you fear is ugly or flawed or broken in you. And my experience, and this is backed up by some beautiful research in the States, is that there is genius, there is greatness in each of us innately. Unless there is some congenital problem, there is a capacity for innovation, for creativity, for wisdom that is innate. The difficulty that we experience in life, and the Enneagram is pointing to some of this, that greatness, that capacity gets covered over, it gets layered over by our attempts to avoid what we fundamentally fear. And the greatness gets covered and gets distorted. And so for me, any truly valuable personal growth work is a process not of addition, but of subtraction, subtracting the lies, pulling back the veils, peering into what is essentially whole and brilliant, and allowing that to express in life.
Thank you. Thank you. That was my direction a little bit. They've got some other questions they should really honor, but thank you for that. Henry says, can you explain the lines on the diagram connecting some of the different expressions?
Yeah, very briefly, the triangular lines and the blue lines indicate directions of movement. So under eustress or distress, if we're wholly fixated at a given point, at any one point, and we will be, we will also experience the points at the end of those lines. So the red triangle lines or the blue straight lines. So if we're feeling great about ourselves, we may go in one direction. If we're feeling really stressed, we may go in another direction. And for a while, I mean, use those games, adopt some of those behaviors and experience a different form of pain ultimately, but there you go. So it's part of the dynamic. There's more of a dynamic to the Enneagram than that, but in simple terms, they're lines of movement. If you will experience what is on the other end of the lines that connect from your core point of fixation.
Thank you. That helps me understand that too. Thank you. Lana says, I feel like I'm not sure which one I most identify with. How can I explore this and know for sure? I feel like different things about different ones resonate with me.
Okay. The way to be clearest about this is to, and I'm going to advise just a short little self-guided introspection here. If you really relax and go into like a meditative state, welcome a mentor who will take you back to childhood when your games were kicking off, when your behaviors were really kind of, you knew you were kind of, you were in flow, you were stropping or hiding or pulling back or kneading or something like this, when your fixation games were playing. And to really ask at the deepest level, what were these behaviors designed to allow me to avoid emotionally? It's the emotional avoidances that are the most deeply pointing here. If we contrast behaviors, it gets very confusing because many of the points behave like other points under different circumstances. But the core avoidances, which I described, are the factors that drive the whole show and cause it to express. So get a mentor in a meditation, get a mentor to take you back to childhood and go, what was it most important that you avoided? Emotionally, what was life or death to you? For me, my core fixation here is at 0.9. And when I do that, it was evident from early childhood, my job was to be a referee. My job was to be a peacemaker because I was terrified of other people's rage and terrified of my own rage. So That's the short answer. And obviously, you know, there are more inquiries you can make here that I don't have time to cover today, Matthew, in order to get clear.
I appreciate that. If we look in the chat box, there is a link to a seminar that Kevin is, if we can bring that back forwards into the events, that, the journey, Enneagram interested, it's worth taking a capture of that and potentially chasing and following that up with Kevin. Next question. These questions get voted to the top, so they move around and jump a bit as people get connected to them. What other Enneagram, this is from Laura Gibson, what other Enneagram teachers or books do you resonate with the most or find the most inspirational and insightful from?
Okay, I'm going to be a party pooper here because I'm going to say I don't really recommend any. And the reason for that is that virtually every book out there is written as if the Enneagram is describing who you are, is describing personality type. And that is a fundamental, I want to say, misuse of what the Enneagram can be. And so I can't recommend any is the honest truth. They will describe traits, they'll describe personalities, they'll describe behaviors, but none of them gets to what I'm pointing at here. And so I'm in the process of writing one myself. If I can be bold enough to say, I'll recommend that when I've finished it. But at the moment, there's nothing that comes from a bottom-up model here that gets back to fundamentals and goes, okay, this is why. This is what underpins these behaviors. Because ultimately, it's not about our behaviors. It's what about causes those behaviors to generate and to self-perpetuate.
Thank you. Thank you. Right. From that, what gave you the capacity to take what is a fairly confusing or not paradoxical, but something like that, yeah, to be able to bridge that, to make use then of how to use the model? What references, what sources did you draw on?
Good question, Matthew. In one word, the journey, two words, the journey work, I was going to say. So the work that Brandon developed, and I've been a partner with her in for the last 26 years. With journey work, it allows us to explore what happens when we peel away the masks and when we penetrate the lies and the falsehoods of ego. And so over that amount of years, working with the tens and into hundreds of thousands of people we've worked with, the Enneagram has taught us organically. So it's taught us from direct experience. Most of the books out there, if not all the books, are written from observation of behavior and then the extrapolations we make from that. But with the journey, we've been able to see, you know, what organically drives this. What happens when you open emotionally and go deeper? What does that reveal about the individual fixation? So it's been a constant teacher for us for 24 years, and Brandon, I think 30-something years. So it's organic experience with a huge number of people, and it's not theory-based. It's based on deep and practical exploration, on direct experience.
Thank you. I was delighted to have brought Kevin's wife, Brandon Bays, into the conference as well. And I have a personal experience of the journey, and I know the impact of the capacity to move through layers and insights that come from that. So I'd highly recommend that we follow that up as well in inquiry into the Enneagram. Camilla asks a question that hasn't been asked in a different form. What is the relationship between Jungian archetypes and the Enneagram perspective?
I have no idea, Matthew. I'm not versed with Jungian types, so I couldn't even begin to answer that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, fair enough.
I've immersed myself in this model to the exclusion of others. I mean, I did study the kind of Myers-Briggs personality typing way back in the, early 90s, but I found that very fixed and ultimately not very helpful. This is a living, dynamic model that is really exposing the underbelly in us and the underbelly that drives what we don't want to the surface. You know, it drives the self-sabotage. It drives the breaks with empathy. It drives the hiding, the separation, the barricading. It drives all of the unhealthy behaviors and traits that we wish we could resolve in life to the surface. And then when we look at that deep level of causality, we've got somewhere really targeted to do our work and to meet what we need to meet, to clear what we need to clear, to be ultimately free and to loosen up in fixation and to see through the lie of who we've pretended to be. So that has fascinated me and has drawn me in for all that time. If you ask me to contrast with other models, I think you need to talk to someone else. I'm so sorry.
It's the right answer when it comes to speaking from honesty and experience. So I appreciate that. The younger me that would have liked to consciously know everything would have lied at that point. So. We're getting close to the end, unfortunately. So I'm going to select one last question from here, although there's more that are appearing. From Teresa Corbett, that's had her question there for a while. I have studied the Enneagram and am a counsellor. Would you recommend a course or training that integrates the Enneagram wisdom into counselling skills? Thank you.
The only way that I know for that is deeply effective is to combine the Enneagram with Brandon's journey training. Brandon does an online practitioner training, used to be live until COVID, now it's online. The two go together amazingly because when we're willing to uncover these emotions that we've buried and been afraid of, combine that discovery, that uncovering with journey techniques that really allow us to open emotionally and to discover that emotions, any emotions, are in fact neutral. And that they do not define us, they do not control us, they don't even disrupt much in life. If we learn that they're pure energy and when they're tweaked, we just stop and open with them, there's massive learning, there's massive teaching, and there's the experience of falling into deep self-realization when we do this. So the Enneagram is a tool of pointing, of unearthing the things that we've not wanted to admit about ourselves, the things that we've been asleep to in ourselves, and then journey work to resolve the emotional consequences of that discovery and the awakening that comes from it.
Thank you. That's quite a nice conclusive statement as well, in terms of embracing a model and how to use and unpack your points within it. How practically you would use in the world. Thank you very much, Matthew.
I'm thrilled to have been here and to have shared like this. Thank you for the invitation.
I'm delighted you have come here and shared it with the clarity that you have. I appreciate your authority in these fields and your relationship with your wife has obviously facilitated the depth which is a delight to have here in the conference, even if it's frustratingly short period of time. These gems and bright points add along the way. So I appreciate you bringing those two here. I'm going to do a bit of a wrap, but while I'm doing that, if you could consider this question, what would be your top tip, embodiment tip? So give yourself a moment to think about that. And then I'm going to ask you to say, what is your top tip, embodiment tip? So thank you, Kevin. Thank you so much for your presentation. These are our bright points in our conference, and there are many. And we have 48 hours to watch them free. After that, it goes through into the portal, which will wrap all those up and edit them and make them look quite pretty and develop learning lists. And it's well worth investing in it now. In 2 days' time, it'll double in price. And that's not a discouragement. It's just we have to cover the cost of this free festival, this free movement, this initiation. So do look into that. There is also a way to donate for those that can to support our work and to corral the community that we have in a way that enables this kind of information to spread and to change the world. We have coffee breaks that you can join and meet in the Facebook groups and through the portal. Please do that. And make sure you capture the events, the journey, Enneagram interested link in the chat box before that closes. I think that's a good investment for anybody's time. Kevin, your top tip, please, for us at the Embodiment Conference.
I would say stop, open, welcome whatever emotions are triggered in the moment, and dive inwards. Tell the truth of who you really are and stop telling the lies of the masks of the fixated behaviors and patterns. That's not who you are. You're something more magnificent, wiser, deeper, infinite, eternal.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate your authority in that. Kevin, it's been a real treat having you here. Thank you very much. I won't ask you to sing your way out. I've already heard a song that I appreciate. That's great. Thank you for sharing your time with us and your expertise.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Goodbye.